Best part of waking up. I feel so stupid today. I don't know how I'm gonna do this. I'm gonna do it. I'm gonna do it. I'm gonna do it.
Breathing exercises? I want the sizzle, not the steak.
From movies to video games, welcome to Marie Plays It All. Today's episode is a deep dive into Rob Zombie's Halloween 2, a very polarizing movie, more so than the first one. It has, not that we care about reviews here, really, personally, like our personal feelings only care about what the reviews say, but just for perspective, it's got a 25% critic score on Rotten Tomatoes and 44% audience score. We don't care about, do we? It doesn't matter. But today we have Jose Ramos here with us and Kevin Fetchy here with us. And the reason why I wanted to have especially these two people is because I know we're going to have different opinions on this movie. And I think it's so important to share different opinions. And I love hearing what people are passionate about, even if it's in a negative way, and especially if it's in a positive way. And I think we just got to have more talks about different opinions on everything in this world. And let's start with movies. We'll start with movies and work our way up.
It's a good place to start.
Jose, we'll start with you. How are you doing today, Jose?
Doing good. Doing good. Once this cup's all gone, I'll be doing even better.
Sounds good. What about you, Kev?
I'm good. I have not been on a podcast in so long. I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know how this is going to go, but I'm excited to be here. I'm almost overwhelmed with excitement because of how much this movie means to me. It's almost like whenever I hear anyone talking about H2, it's like the bat signal is lit up in the sky and I show up. But, you know, I know the odds are not in my favor because of the overall general hate that this movie gets. So I really want to be the one to advocate for it because I do think it is severely misunderstood, and a part of that inertia, that momentum of people that like to hate on something just because someone tells you to hate on it and they think it's cool to hate on something, but also understanding that this film is not for everybody. It is a very acquired taste, a very dark, nasty, brutal taste. So I do understand it, but I just think there are specific films out there that are destined to be yours, and this one is mine, so I'm excited.
Damn, you're getting me in the feels already. Yeah, when Jose and I did the Rob Zombie first Halloween deep dive, we discussed doing both the movies in one and then splitting up the movies, because we can talk for a long time about movies, and then I said, you know what, Jose, we got to bring my friend Kevin in on this one because he has a very different and it's like an eye-opening viewpoint on this movie where it's like, I wouldn't have looked at it that way. I watched it again last night and I was like, okay, let's get into the mindset of this being like a certain way. I still don't know exactly how you feel about it, which is why I'm excited for it. But I really wanted Jose to hear your side. I want to hear Jose's side because he's been holding out on me. He's been holding out on me hard with this movie. So I'm excited to get into it. And I want the world to hear your perspective on this too, Kevin Ketchy, because it's a very different one that you don't hear very often. So
absolutely. Yeah.
I definitely am excited to hear it overall because, you know, watching this movie, I watched it. It was the same thing with the first Halloween. I watched them when they first came out, but these were ones that I never revisited again. And then just a few weeks ago, I was like, what the heck? Let me give these a try again in there. And I gained a whole new appreciation for the first one. And then I rewatched this one. So I definitely could, because I did find things that I appreciated about it, regardless of my overall thoughts on the movie. So I definitely was excited to hear another perspective of someone who fully appreciates it. Just in case, maybe there's some things that I'm viewing a little bit differently or didn't catch through my two viewings.
Yeah, I still have my ticket stub from when I went to see this August 31st, 2009. It has somehow made it through. Look at that.
Oh, I can still read it.
Oh my gosh. 650.
It has still, that's what I was looking at. Just like the price difference from back then, but it has somehow made its way through like multiple washes and wallets, and I still have it to this day, which I just think is really like apropos for how this movie has like found its way to me and its impact on me. And so, yeah, I'm just very, very, very excited.
Okay, well, let's get into it. And also, if there's things that we don't like about it and we want to really express it, Kevin can handle it. I mean, he did the Terrifier 2 thing with me, and I raked that movie through the coals, man, and I didn't care what anybody thought about it. So if we want to talk about some really poopy parts of this movie, we can handle it, even though he loves it, right?
Yeah, I mean, I've heard everything that's wrong with this movie, so I won't be hearing anything that I haven't heard before. So please, like, unleash it all. This is why we're doing this. It's gonna be fun.
Okay, well, let's start out easy and simple and just a little more on surface level type things, just to get going. And I want to talk about the characters in the movie and basically the contrast between the first one to number two and like the contrast of the characters. So I will start first. We'll start first with Michael. Jose, how do you feel about Michael in this movie, and especially in comparison to the first one?
Out of the characters from the first and the second, I think Michael is one of the characters that I didn't really have too much of a problem with him himself in this one. I like the grisly look that continued on from like the first one. There was this like dirty and grittiness like to him. The violence was all still there. So that aspect I did like. One of the character aspects that I wasn't that much of a fan of is what I really liked about the first one is we kind of saw his progression from, child that was a little bit disturbed, kind of had those intrusive thoughts where then they did with the animals. And we kind of saw his progression kind of becoming emotionless robot, pretty much like machine. Where especially once the mom was out of the picture and all of that, and with this one, it seemed like his character started going, reverting back more towards looking for like a connection, which when the last one we kind of spent time removing those connections from him, turning him into what he was at the end of the movie. So in that aspect, I felt like we kind of were going a little bit backwards with the character itself as we went further in the movie. So that was my thoughts on Michael himself.
Mm-hmm.
All right, yeah. Kevin, rebuttal.
No, I don't have a whole lot to add. I think that's very well said. I just love the evolution or de-evolution of this character. I don't have much to say. I just think, going back to 07, Rob balancing his style with the callbacks was not easy to do. With the amount of pressure from just reigniting the Halloween story, rekindling the story, having to kind of appease the fan base and just carrying the weight of remaking arguably the greatest slasher of all time, is not an easy task to do while also, putting in your specific type of flavor, your art. And I think we are very lucky. It turned out as good as it did because there was so much studio interference and meddling every second that he was in production. For me, 07 feels more like it's definitely the more rewatchable out of the two. Like, I as much as I love 09, I can't just turn it on and just feel all nice and cozy. Like, 07 to me is just a very beautiful looking film. It almost feels like a cinnamon whiskey shot that blooms warmth in my chest. I love all the performances. I think everyone is so natural and perfectly cast. But, in 09, the reason, well, I won't get into the reason why I love it as much as I do yet, but I think it's bold. I think he explores the aftermath. Like, it's a terror train destined straight for catastrophic affliction. Like, there is no happy ending, and how could there be? And I think that is such a rarity. But going to Michael, I just love his progression. Like, it feels like, of course, he would be this type of like mammoth primitive Grim Reaper that's trudging on the peripherals of Haddonfield. And I just love the many optic decisions throughout 07 and 09, well, with like the jack-o'-lantern mask, the white satin mask, the aged mask. I could go on and on, but I just think everything is so tastefully done and detailed. And so is like the appearance of Michael and his character.
I fully agree. I thought in this movie, I was so, one of my most favorite things about this movie is finally he's giving us what Michael's doing when it's not Halloween, what Michael is up to, what he looks like. Cause that's always been my thought. I've always been like, okay, well, where is Michael hiding out? Like during the off season, you know, why is he clean shaven all the time? Like it is like, I'm assuming under that mask. Like I absolutely love the humanizing of Michael Myers in these two films. And it's like extra apparent in this movie, especially just seeing like the Hobo Myers, they call him, just seeing him like that. I love seeing his whole face. You get to see his whole face in this. It's the only Halloween movie I will ever say that I love the fact that we see his face in this one. And we get to see him consuming a dog. Finally, we get to see it happen. And I love that he added that. I love it. I love how animalistic Michael is in this one, just like pure rage and brutality. And he's like grunting like an animal when he's like, you know, and I loved Michael in this movie and the first one. But it's like one of my most favorite interpretations of Michael Myers is what Rob Zombie did with him.
Yeah, he's not like just hiding in a sewer randomly after the previous film gave him superpowers. I just love that he is this mammoth elemental force with instinctual intellectual drive, and he's on a path to destroy anything and everything in that path in order to find what he's after, which is his baby sister. And so I just love the multiple kind of motives and layers that Rob introduced into this character. I just think it's really refreshing and bold.
Yeah, that was, well, I'd say, one of the things that I did like about the movie, what they did with Michael, that you don't really see in other movies. And then they even go beyond Michael, you see in these type of movies in general, is the fact that he felt real in this movie when you see him. You know, someone who's this basically, again, supposed to be this emotionless, you know, machine that you don't get in its path or it's going to take you out and things like that. They're not going to find time for like personal hygiene. So that was like one thing when I saw, you know, he's not going to fresh press his, you know, his jumpsuit or any of that stuff. So seeing him like grunging, torn, the mask isn't repaired, you know, he didn't go to, you know, a local Halloween store and get like another mask and paint it up. I felt that was a good thing that a lot of people don't think of when they're creating these movies, those little tiny details. So that I really appreciated that they included with this character, makes it feel more real. And in that aspect, that was a continuation from the first one. So what I liked about the 07 one is how grounded and real it felt.
Perfectly said, you two. Perfectly said. All right, let's move on to Lori. Okay, so Lori, in the first one, she's like, you know, sweet, smart,
very little, happy, bubbly,
happy, innocent. And then we move to the broken, haunted, more self-destructive Lori. Okay, we'll start with you, Kevin.
My favorite. I think Scout really shines when she absolutely has to. She's just this unfiltered victim riddled with trauma and drug abuse. Like, even in your favorite scene in that therapy session, you know, when she is a bit grating on the ears, like I buy that. It feels like the room is being flooded with this festering rage, and you can really see the unraveling begin to speed up. To me, she played the part of a final girl with PTSD, like really, really convincing. And especially when she finds Annie, I think her and Brad really nailed that scene. I'll hold off on Brad, but I just think Scout did a tremendous job, like trying to fill the shoes of Jamie Lee Curtis. And she's such a different type of Lori, too. Like, Jamie Lee Curtis's Lori was very introverted, shy, kind of meek, bookwormed, and then Scout's Lori, and the first one is, like you said, very bubbly, very happy, extroverted. But then I love the contrast in H2, where it's just a complete descent into madness and where she's kind of destined to go. So I love her performance and how she plays the character.
Lori, I know, I can't disagree there. Lori, again, was one of the ones that was portrayed very well in here. And a lot of times with these, when you do have a final girl survive into a second movie or a third movie, they'll lightly touch on the effects of what they experience in the first one. So they might get some nightmares. They might like get a little bit of paranoia. But this took it to a whole other level, which I did like, because again, it's very realistic. Not everyone's going to deal with the trauma the same. So to expect every final girl to get tougher and thicker skin off of trauma is not very realistic, because it's not always going to happen. So it was refreshing to see a new look of someone pretty much being completely broken, you know, even with a support system from, you know, from Annie, who's trying to be supportive, the sheriff who kind of, you know, took her in, the therapist who's there, you know, trying to help in her own way. Sometimes that's not always enough in there. So it was good to then to show that side, because sometimes even therapy doesn't work, or a specific therapist might not be the right one for you. And a lot of times in movies, they portray it in a way where it's like, it's almost that that silver bullet in helping in their recovery. So I think that was a plus, and that was one of the highlights of this movie to me, is it showed overall the variety of how PTSD and trauma can affect an individual, and she is like one window on how it could do it. But some of the other characters, and we'll get into it, they were changed in different ways, or they handled it in different ways. So it created a good contrast.
Well said.
It made sense for Lori to be that broken and that upset and like that, like self-destructive. It's not like terribly self-destructive, but like going down that path, because she actually believes that she eliminated Michael. Like, so she's not only dealing with the trauma of being attacked, but the trauma of eliminating somebody. You know what I mean? It's very different. Like, we don't really get to see that in other Laurie Strode versions, right? Except for, well, in Halloween Resurrection, when she's in the insane asylum. But also, she's actually not crazy in that one. She just still knows that he's coming. But anyway, this is just a very, I love how it's just a very different take on Laurie Strode. It doesn't feel, no, I don't want to say that, I don't think. I was gonna say, it doesn't really feel like Laurie Strode, but it's not supposed to. It's not supposed to. It's a totally different interpretation. This is what I think people have a problem with. And I don't really have this problem with the first one, but there is a little bit in the second one, is like kind of disassociating Halloween, what we know of, and the Rob Zombie Halloween. That was a little bit harder for me in this one. But anyways, we'll get to that. But let's move on to Dr. Loomis. I need to talk about Dr. Loomis in this movie. We have to, because this is also a drastic change. And Jose, we'll start with you, because I know you have thoughts about Dr. Loomis in this movie.
Unlike Michael and Laurie, this I had a problem with. This was really taking me out of the movie. So Loomis is obvious, had a complete like 180 from kind of, first of all, the Loomis that we already know, but even just eliminate that. Like, you know, I'm able to separate from the other Halloweens, but these two, they're together. They're a whole. So I like to see good progression and transitions, realistic transitions between both movies, character to character, because they take place in the same world. They're, you know, one is a sequel to the other. And it felt too much of a shift for Loomis from where kind of what we saw him in the first one. I know I had seen that part of the reason they did the shift, if they were kind of supposedly, and you guys probably will know more on this, they were trying to mirror him after there was this lawyer, I believe it was in the Manson case, who once that was done, he kind of became money hungry and fame hungry and all that. Yeah. So I understand that there is a real life sample, but that, for me, that's a lawyer. This is a psychiatrist. So, you know, you kind of get into this understanding human behavior in there. And in the last movie, kind of we see that empathetic side and his understanding of human behavior to the point that he's able to kind of see what Michael may become before Michael becomes that. So it shows that he's in tune with human behavior and the effects that can be had both internally and externally on that. And it seems for this movie, that kind of all went out the window, where any empathy, any attachment to the consequences of actions just kind of went out the window. The way he treats his assistant, the way he just callously reveals such an important aspect of Laurie without even really considering the effect, the anguish that can have as your profession that he was probably doing for a long time, because he was no spring chicken. He wasn't new to that profession. It just seemed so callous and so different. Like, this is the guy in the last movie who the sheriff was trying to ignore him, and he was just fighting tooth and nail. Like, you need to listen to me. You need to listen to this. He went from that to just, whatever. Like, just need fame, need money. And then at the end, he just switches like nothing, like kind of going back to it. And it was too extreme of a flip that it took me out. Unlike Laurie and Michael, where it felt like natural progressions, this felt like a forced progression. That was my problem with Loomis in this one.
He's too snip, snap, snip, snap, snip, snap. Like back
he was.
And forth, back and
forth. It was. Look, I get it. In this movie, he's just an ass. He's a greedy, money-hungry ass who is so far away from the warm, lovable, geriatric hoot that Donald Pleasance created. And, you know, arguably the heart of the franchise is Dr. Loomis. But I also feel like this iteration of Loomis is very fathomable and believable. Like, people exploit and profit off of everything today, off of other people's misery. So it's pretty grounded in reality there. And also, just speaking on Malcolm McDowell, I also find like a ton of comedy in his performance, but just like how out of touch and self-indulgent he plays the character. Like, he's got some one-liners, man, that just crack me up. Like, businesswoman, I want the sizzle, not the steak. But but no, I definitely understand like the pushing that character into kind of foul territory, but I also think it isn't out of the realm of possibility and continues to be an element of just like the overall inevitable doom that's in the air, the decay of everything and of everyone. And, you know, going back to 07, when Dr. Loomis is at Smith's Grove with young Michael, and Michael's got that mask he made and it's all black. He's talking to Michael about the color of it, and Michael's like, oh, it's black, it's my favorite color. And Loomis is like, ah, well, you know, black is not a color, it's the absence of color. And so to me, like, Michael is just this abyss, this black hole that is consuming everyone one way or another. And that includes, you know, Dr. Loomis.
Damn. Yeah. Okay. I agree that the character had a pretty drastic step sideways.
Yeah.
A pretty intense swap. But I also could see, I remember first watching it, I actually really liked that aspect. Because I'm like, this is totally what people would do, man. This is totally what people do. And just to sell out and be just like money hungry, like power hungry. But I also look at it kind of maybe like, even though he's a psychiatrist, I know what you're saying, Jose, like that's like for a lawyer, I could see it way more than like a psychiatrist who's like dedicated his life to the craft, you know? But it's almost to me, like, I wonder if it's like Loomis's own coping mechanism on how to deal with what happened, and like his failure with Michael, and like his guilt with his like self-involvement with the whole thing that happened. That's what it kind of seemed like to me last night when I watched it. I was like, it's like almost he's putting up that wall and becoming something totally different to forget about it. I'm going to deal with it my own way, even though a psychologist should know better. But maybe he's not a great psychologist after all, right? Because Michael didn't seem to get any better. Like, maybe he's not so great. But then I also look at it like it's a Rob Zombie movie, man. So having characters go down a more dark path just seems to be like if he stayed like warm and fuzzy and wanted to help out and was really empathetic and stuff, it would feel less Rob Zombie-ish. I feel. So it kind of suit the movie, but I agree with it being such a snap this way, and then at the end, wait a minute, actually snap that way. I wish there was a little more layers, or we saw his snap back to goodness take longer, or like there was like some really there's like a scene in there that was really like more deep or something. I don't know, but that's what I
Yeah.
felt about it.
Yeah. And then I like the idea of Michael doing this like black abyss that kind of through or like a black hole is kind of affecting everything around them and all that. I like the idea. I think for me it would have worked better if in the first one, if we saw light hints of this kind of scene there. To have such an overhaul in behavior when people have these big changes, usually those red flags are in there beforehand. It might not be 100% of them, not maybe 50%, but every once in a while you see a little bit of like, okay, this is in there. And then you might have a triggering event or a trauma or something that might push the scale all the way towards that and kind of, reverse it in any way. I just didn't feel like I saw hints of that in the first iteration in the first movie, to then have this big like already, if they would have given me some hints, I feel like I would have bought in more with this character using this as a coping mechanism, kind of just switching away because it was like, all right, in the first one, there was some moments where it was like, okay, get a little, dick in them. Right? I think it would have made for a smoother transition for me going into the second one. And then that big change, I think, would not have pulled me away as much.
I think that's fair.
I see that.
I was going to touch on Danielle Harris's and Brad Dourif's performance real quick. I would like to say Brad Dourif's performance for the end because to me, he makes this movie. And arguably, Danielle Harris makes both of these with her performance. But I'll talk about Danielle first. I'm just like genuinely so glad that Rob kept her character alive in this. For one, to see how much damage this has done between these two best friends. And, maybe Annie was left alive to help further the erosion of Lori into Angel. Just a thought there. And two, just like how great of an actress Danielle Harris is. So whenever her death does come, like the weight of that, just thinking about her acting and her involvement in this franchise in totality just adds so much more like emotion and weight to her performance and to that death. But touching on Brad Dourif, like to me, his performance, in my opinion, is pound for pound the most guttural, sincerely heartbreaking performance in all of horror. I think the grief and sorrow that's felt while discovering his daughter violated and decidedly dead is unlike anything in any horror film like I have ever seen. The agonizing failure of protecting the only thing in his life that he had left. And we are left to sit intimately in this frozen moment of time as memories of once were, like was sinks in to remind us how fleeting and how fragile life can be. But it's just so beautifully and powerfully performed. Like watch the director's cut. That's where it's extended and Brad really shines there. But man, I just think that is when this movie reached out and grabbed a hold of me and has yet to let go since. And I'd argue it's the single most affecting death in the history of slasher films. It is a powerful performance and a powerful scene.
And honestly, I can't disagree there. Starting with Danielle and the Annie character, I felt it was a good yin yang with Laurie here, with how the trauma affected them and how their PTSD from it took them in different directions in here, where while Laurie was just slowly eroding from who she was before, Annie seemed to become more of a protective, like motherly figure through it, which really shown in those scenes where you would see that visceral confrontation between them, where it's just kind of they're like, "What are you doing, Laurie?" Like she's trying to help you, but it's understandable that people don't always take help when it's right there in front of them. They're not always ready for it. So she was kind of fighting back. And I feel, maybe seeing Annie's character put together because that's what we see in the outside. We don't know what's going on in the inside. Put together, probably help fuel more of Lori's rage because she couldn't get to that point that it appeared that Annie was at. So it kind of, again, it creates that contrast between them, how they both handle, because at that point, for a lot of it, she doesn't know yet who she is in relation to Michael. In their eyes, they were both attacked by a stranger. So they have that shared experience with no other connection at that point. So they took the same experience and handled it in two different ways. So I felt she was very important into what we were seeing from Laurie. Without her, I think what we saw from Laurie will still hit, but not as strongly without Annie. And then with Brad, that scene itself, like you can feel the pain there, and just the whole thought of last time he was just in time, and this time he just missed it. Like he couldn't even see like her final breath and her final, moments in there. Lori is the one who saw those. That was tough. And even by the end of it, when it's like, okay, now you lost both, like the two that you were in charge of, and of course he loved his daughter, but then you could tell he grew to love Lori also as a daughter. So going from having that little family, covered in trauma, but still a family, to losing that. And yeah, that was tough. And his performance, it came out. It was very realistic. At no point during his performance did you not believe that he was feeling what he should be feeling. So he was, I agree with you, he was kind of one the MVP of the movie itself.
I just buy the pain in this movie. I think it is palpable. I think it is genuine. And then going back to Danielle and Scout's performance, like when they're going at each other's throats, I buy that. I think that is tremendously acted. It's very effective. And I just think, like you said, I think Annie has a little bit more together and she is trying to keep it together for herself and for Lori. But I just think Lori sees almost a mirror image where she sees like the scarred aftermath and she can't cope with it. She can't deal with it. It's everywhere. It is so consuming. And I also think she's just infected with the rage virus. And so there really is there's no way to help Lori at this point. And I just think it's very layered.
Yeah, and then it makes sense that she is, that far gone at that point, because the only, I'm not even counting the therapist, but the only people there to help her get through it have their own trauma from the same incident. It's not like she was back with her foster parents who may have survived from the first one, and they're kind of disconnected and they can provide that love. The people themselves are trying to do what they can for her. But then they're also dealing with their own stuff. Annie, like you said, trying to keep it together and kind of internalizing a lot of it. And then with Brad, you've got that paranoia that comes with it. Not even about himself, but about his two girls. So he's dealing with like that, where he's, sending, cops to his door. And we know that wasn't the first incident by their dialogue. So he's dealing with that constant paranoia of like, can I lose them at any point? Or can I keep them safe? And anyone as a parent feeling that, there's going to be a helplessness to it. So these are the people that she can lean on for support, because her friends were more enablers in this, in her enabling her lifestyle. So those are the two people, but they can't give her 100% of what she needs, because they're using a lot of that percentage for themselves.
Yeah, I'm like tearing up, you guys. This is like I don't really have much to add, because you guys said everything just so perfectly, and like everything I was thinking and things I didn't even think of that now I'm feeling now. I agree with everything you said. I love that. I hate saying I love the scene, like with Annie's death and Sheriff Brackett like holding her, and just the feel. And I love the fact that she's naked, because it's just like that's his baby, and it just makes me think of the day you were born. He had this naked baby covered in blood, and then that's how she leaves, and his arms just like naked, covered in, oh
I didn't even
God.
think about that.
Yeah.
Damn.
That was one of my notes. I always loved that. That's a
good call.
Because sometimes in slasher movies, like, oh, the girl's in the robe, and the robe came off, I guess, and like now she's nude. Oh, it's a slasher movie, but this was so meaningful and so sad, and just the fact, it's like she had to be nude in that scene with like, and it's kind of uncomfortable. You're like, oh God, this man and his naked teenage daughter, but at the same time, it's like, no, that's his baby, and that's how he always sees her, is this helpless
Yeah.
baby, and it's just, oh, that
And
really.
then in the director's cut, I don't think it's in the theatrical, you get a flash of young Danielle Harris as a kid with like a dog. And it's just like, oh
Yeah.
man, it is brutal. And so like it just adds more to your perspective, which I've never even thought about. And I love that. One scene I wanted to touch on real quick between the three of them, like the only lighthearted good scene is when they're at the dinner table and they're eating pizza, and Brad Dourif is being such a good father and a father figure to Lori. And it's like the whole leave Marvin thing. I just think it's really wholesome. And then Lori has that moment where she has that connection with Michael, with like the consumption of the dog and the pizza, and she gets sick. And oh man, it's just like the closer Michael gets to her with each step, she's almost eclipsing into him and has these nightmarish visions. And there's just no, she's too far gone. Like it is inevitable. But I do love that scene.
Yeah, that's a really good observation there, Marie, because I had a prop. The scene is great, so I like the scene, but the fact of her being nude kind of took me out a little bit, because I was like, wait, I see Michael Myers as a killer. You know, he kills, not more than that. And then the fact that when he got there and he started chasing her, she was clothed, and then when he left, she was naked. I was just like, wait, what more happened there? And thinking about that, I didn't like that for that character, because it was hard for me to see Michael going through the effort of stripping her down and maybe other abuse happening in that scene, more than just the physical torture or jabbing or things like that. So that kind of pulled me a little bit, because I was just like, wait, why did he do that? Like, did something else happen? And then thinking about that, it felt out of character for Michael himself.
I don't think I ever viewed it as Michael did anything else, and that's why she's naked. I just have never seen Michael Myers, like, especially this one, as any, like, that doesn't run through his head. Like, I don't feel that
Yeah.
way, but I can see how you would feel that way, and that there's that thought, like, oh God, like, why? But I think that's why it was so smart that she was in a robe, because robes can so easily come off, like, if she's trying to run away and like he's pulling at her. Like, if she was wearing, like,
Yeah.
if she was fully clothed and like jeans and like everything's done up and then she was nude, I'd be like, okay, so there was time there to take everything off. But because she was in a robe that's just so easy, like so flimsy and just come right off, I think that scene was extremely thought out that way for that reason. And I think ultimately she like would have to be nude, because I don't know if Rob was thinking about that, like the baby and stuff, but I just, for me, that was the first place my mind went, and I like to look at it like that, instead of
Yeah.
Michael don't do that stuff. Michael doesn't say.
I
Yeah.
prefer that. I think maybe there was a little bit of influence knowing this is Rob Zombie, and then like right before we cut off, she's there quivering in the corner and she's still clothed at that point. And then the mom says, like, have fun or have your fun, something along those lines. And then the next time we see her, that's the case that she's in. So that's I think that's why I was like, I hope not. But it doesn't look good.
Yeah, I
Yeah.
see that.
I think that's a very valid thought, but I was just gonna echo Maria. I think because it got so brutal and violent, and him just, grabbing onto her, slinging her from wall to wall, being in a bathrobe, that was very easy to just get ripped off or cut off, thrown off. And so that's what I felt like what happened. But also, I don't think you are the only person that's ever thought that, because this is a Rob Zombie movie and that stuff has happened in his movies, but I don't believe that that's what happened. But I do understand where you're coming from.
I'm gonna go with it didn't. I'd rather go with it didn't
Yeah,
happen. It didn't
It
happen. It didn't happen. Okay, so since we're talking about like scenes and stuff, then maybe, yeah, maybe let's move on to like directing style, cinematography. There's a lot more. I feel like the cinematography and everything is a lot more artistically done in this movie than the first one. So let's move on to a little bit of that. And like, I also want to touch on a couple of other scenes too. So we'll talk about like the filming and all that stuff. Kevin, you want to start this one?
Yeah, cinematography. This one was shot by Brandon Trost, and it is shot on gritty 16mm. And I honestly could catalog over 100 shots in this movie that still take my breath away. Like from the jump, Laurie walking down the street of Haddonfield, it's wet, it's rainy. She's just like completely in shock. And then you get to the hospital and the makeup effects by Wayne Toth. And, there's compound fractures. She's a mangled, bloody mess. And it just looks realistic as hell. And, then you get to the hospital, and that sequence is just like gorgeous. It might be my favorite horror scene in cinematic history. Like, are you kidding? You get the Octavia Spencer death, which is my favorite in the franchise, and she shows up with that slit down her face, and that scream is so scary. And then you got like the jack-o'-lantern lights strung up across the blinds, and then Michael comes in, and man, just the lighting's very bleak. You get the in the director's cut, Lori falls down and into like this dumpster of bodies that has like this red lighting, and then Michael's walking out. He looks like this big, like roided up giraffe kinda. And then you get like the TV with knights in white satin, and so you get the foggy field illuminated by like the rednecks' truck lights when Michael puts his mask on, and even like the wide shots of Michael roaming the countryside, just trudging along is like really gorgeous. Haunting, spooky stuff. The Phantom Jam, like that feels so Halloween to me. Like, what a great production design. Like, what a great set with all the costumes and the lights. And I actually went to go see Halloween 2 there. They shot it in Georgia, so we got to watch inside of there. But man, I just think it's probably my favorite looking horror film. Like, it doesn't have the ethereal Dean Cundey optics of 78, but to me, it just feels like autumn and captures the essence and the soul of Halloween.
Yeah, overall, I felt the look and the way it was shot and the way it was lit throughout fit the theme of the movie itself, and like you said, the bleakness of it that was shown in the shots. You've got a lot of shots where he's in shadow, like when he's out in the field and it's just the headlights of the truck going through, so you kind of just see his dark silhouette. He looked like a unlocked character in the video game. You just see like his like silhouette in there, but it fit in that aspect. And in the first one, you get more, especially during the first half, you get more. I will call them happy shots when you're like in Haddonfield and being shot in Pasadena. You get those Pasadena views and things like that. You don't really get that here, and I think that kind of fit with this one because this one's kind of gloom from beginning to end. I think moving it, that final scene to like that dungy barn area, I think that really worked for it. There was some really good shots in that first scene. As disappointed I am with that first scene, the shots were really good in that. I like the rain in there when she's inside of the little security office and you just kind of seeing what she's seeing through the window. That way that was shot, that helped build good tension for the scene because you're expecting him to just smash through at any moment. So you kind of are waiting for that. And then the body shots with the red lighting, that was a great shot in there. So definitely the way this was shot overall perfectly fit what the vision was for the movie, in my opinion.
I totally agree. I love the gritty film look. Oh, I just love that so much. I love the color palette. And yeah, there are a lot of moments where it's very warm looking, and he was really good at keeping that warm fall vibe going. But then there's different scenes where it's like the colors are so sharp and like the contrast is way the F up, it seems. And it's like the blacks and the blues and the reds and the whites are just like sharp. There's a lot of scenes too that are really dark but really have really bright lights, like really bright white shining light, like supposed to be moonlight or whatever, but then it's all black and it just reminds me of all the scenes with like the mom and her dress, and it's I don't know what he was thinking with the black and the white. I guess like the good and the evil. I don't know. We'll get into that. But I love the color palette, love the grit. I love the hospital scene in the beginning. I love Lori getting operated on, that whole scene. I was like, yeah, like I just loved it, and taking things out of her nail off, and everything was looked so good. The makeup and the effects were just so good. Okay, so I love that they had the hospital scene keeping like the OG Halloween 2 vibe, because you know, but it wasn't constrained to the hospital. So I kind of liked that it was a dream sequence in the beginning, because he was like, okay, Halloween 2, man, that's Lori in a hospital, so let's put her there, but we're not keeping Lori in a hospital bed in this for this movie. We are not doing it. We got to switch it up, and we got to give a whole other story. So I love that he kept it Halloween 2-ish, but that he was like, but no, this is not what you think it's going to be. I'm switching it up right now.
It just feels like the dead of winter. Like if fall took place in winter, it just feels like this frozen moment in time. Everything feels cold. It just feels like total decay of the characters of the Halloween story of everything. And it just almost overwhelmingly feels like fall to me. It's so crisp, it's so dark, it's so spooky. And then, like you said, you get the backlit fields with the fog and the dress. It's ghostly, it's spooky. And it just, man, it's just a layered film that has a lot to say and a lot to show. And it just embraces me with its mood every time I watch it. I can only watch it on Halloween or during its anniversary, which is, I think, the 28th. But it's not a film I can watch any time of the year. It's specific to Halloween because it feels wrong and sacrilegious if I don't watch on that holiday. But it just through and through feels like fall and Halloween to me, the way it looks.
And kind of going back to the scene, the hospital scene and everything out there, the scene as a whole, I have no problem with the scene. It was well done. I have the problem that it ended up being a dream sequence. And not just that it ended up being a dream sequence, is this was like a 30-minute like dream sequence. That's like a fourth of the movie you spent in a fake out. And that's the thing. Like, if it was, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, and then you're like, oh, it's a fake out, I don't think there's a problem. But you spend a quarter of the movie doing this really cool scene, and then it's just like wiped away. Like, oh no, just a dream in there. That was my issue with that first scene. It went too long for it to be a dream sequence fake out.
I mean, I think that's fair. I think it's fair. It's deflating and it's a bummer that she wakes up screaming. And you're like, oh, that scene was just so rock and roll. Why did it have to be a dream? But they still executed the hell out of it. It's still amazing to watch every year. It still hits. I love it. So I can look past it being just not in reality and it's a dream just because of how well it's done. But I do understand.
Honestly, I would have been happy if we would have gotten, because you've got to keep it, the pretty much the patchwork that they had to do for today. To this day, I gotta feel that is the best portrayal of post-attack damage that someone has taken out of probably any horror like franchise that I've seen in there. Usually they survive. If it's close enough, you may see a couple of nicks in there, they might have some band-aids or thing like that. You saw the level of damage that she physically took through there. That would have been good if they kept that, and then he dreams the attack and kind of wakes up from the nightmare in the hospital, and then we kind of move on. So we still kind of keep that, and then you're sure in that aspect, I think I would have been more happy. But then the whole thing being the dream sequence, it's like, oh no.
I get that, but I will argue I have had so many reoccurring nightmares to where something is after me, some like negative entity, and I know it is going to get me. I know it's going to happen. That's what that dream feels like. You have this supernatural, massive, elemental, unstoppable force that is going to find you, and he does in that dream. And so I think it's symbolic of Lori's fate in a way. It's on its way. And so I can look past that. And I can understand why Rob put that in there. And I still just think it's such a hard-hitting, emotional, and powerful scene to experience over and over.
I agree with both you guys a little bit. It is a little, I can't remember the first time I saw it and if I was disappointed in the dream sequence or if I was like, oh damn, they like you got me. But Rob Zombie seemed to put some Halloween lore in this one, like scenes, like to me when she woke up from that, when she woke up from that dream, I kind of was like, oh, but then I was like, that's just like Halloween H2O. Like, that's just like, that's how it starts in Halloween H2O, except it was like a way shorter, clearly more a dream sequence. So I was like, that's cool. That's cool. He did that. So it's almost like I forgave it a little bit because I'm like, that's what, how that one opens. And I kind of liked it, but I didn't realize how many like kind of very subtle throwback type things that he kept in this movie. Cause you watch it and you're like, this is so different from like any Halloween movie, but then he keeps like the connection, this like kind of the psychic connection that like Jamie and Michael had in 4 and 5.
Yeah.
And I really like that. I like that he told the cop to go sit when the cop's sitting with his gun, like at Annie, like to protect Annie. And like, that's what happens in Halloween 4. I like the bar scene type thing reminded me of the barn scene in Halloween 5, the offing of a guy strung up with lights, just like in Halloween H2O, and the like Rocky Horror Picture Show girl getting like, you know, I don't know if I can say choked, but choked out. And just like Annie did in number 1, like I was like, oh, he's actually putting in a lot of like throwback
That's
things
so
here,
true.
But they're very subtle. They're very subtle. And I didn't pick up on it the first time. I didn't pick up on it the first time at all. Even the girl, I had never seen Rocky Horror Picture Show, so I don't know his name in that movie, but the one's dressed up like Tim Curry's character. She goes off with that Wolfman guy and it reminded me of Tina and that cat guy in Halloween 5. And I was just like, this is so true. Yeah, there was a lot of little like nuggets in this movie that I didn't pick up on before that like Rob was like, oh, I'm going to keep a little bit of the Halloween stuff in there just for you guys. But
dang, good call.
I liked the dream sequence more now because when she woke up, I was like, Halloween H2O, yes. So that made me happy. Okay, so since Jose, we know you didn't like that dream sequence being so long, what else don't you like about this movie, Jose? What else kind of took you out of it or threw you off? Like, what is it about this movie that maybe people are like 44% of Rotten Tomatoes? What are some of the things you don't like?
So again, I look at these two movies as like one entity. They're linked together in there. And when you have movies linked together, you know, it's for me, it's about the transitions. If you're going to put things in part 2, there should be hints of it in part 1. You know, there shouldn't be things too drastic. And one of the things that I really enjoyed about the first one, it was very grounded. It was very grounded out of how it was. And then this one, it appeared to go more into the supernatural aspects of it. And I think that is something that I really didn't like because that's not something that was established in the first one. In these movies, it's 1 and 2. If the other one didn't exist and this isn't the first one, then that wouldn't be an issue for me. But looking at it as a whole, 1 and 2, the supernatural aspects didn't. And I kept trying to maybe explain it away in my head to try to kind of enjoy the experience a little bit more. So I was like, okay, you know, maybe when he sees the mother and the white horse and all of that, you know, maybe that's in his head. That's, you know, a delusion that he is seeing in there, you know, when people get voices in their head or and things like that. And that's kind of what he's using as his guide right now. And I try to explain it that way. But then, you know, that kind of started going out the window and going more towards, okay, this has to be supernatural when you've got the Lori connection of it. When, you know, when she's seeing exactly what he's seeing and seeing the white horse and in the kid, at that point, it's like, okay, that's not his delusion. And it can't be a shared delusion between both of them because they haven't really had shared experiences. You know, she was a baby when all that occurred and he kind of went away and they never saw each other again. So they didn't have experiences growing up together to have that type of shared delusion. And then he dreams basically his first, well, not his first, his second, I guess, murder, like to the T in there. But as a baby, she was in a completely different room in the crib, so she would not have seen that happen. So for her to like dream very vividly the tying up with the tape and the mask and the stabbing in there, the only thing that makes it make sense is there's a supernatural aspect of it, within them, where maybe the mom and them are, it's connecting with both of them, trying to get the family like back together. So that was one of the things I really didn't like, because the first one established this this world where everything is very grounded. Michael Myers isn't supernatural. He's just a gigantic, imposing, force in there. And then here, now we're throwing in some supernatural aspects. So that was one of the main things that I was not a fan of.
Yeah, I think without a doubt, the biggest complaints I hear about this film, the white horse, mm-hmm. Sherry Moon Zombie. Why are they in there? What is this white horse crap? Why does he always have to put his wife in everything? But at the beginning of the movie, he inserts a title card explaining what the white horse represents. Let me read it so I don't forget anything about it. White horse, linked to instinct, purity, and the drive of the physical body to release powerful and emotional forces like rage with ensuing chaos and destruction. So there's like your Jeff Goldblum, well, there it is kind of moment. But I also think it's symbolic of his innocence, not only the innocence of him as a child, but also like the innocence of his kind of strong desire to be home with his mother and his baby sister. And also to me represents like his idolized image of his mother as innocent, as his savior coming to take him away from his isolation. And then if you want to like dig a little further, the book of Revelation from the Bible, their death is seen or is described as riding a pale horse. So here, like the horse symbolizes the theme of death. And so, it is explained from the jump as it being a symbol. Now, I would understand if like Michael came galloping into Haddonfield on the damn thing, like how absurd that would be. But it's just a manifestation that represents both like this animalistic, primordial ferocity and an instinctive, intuitive vision, a driving force on his journey to finding Lori. So that's what the white horse represents to me. And as far as like Sherry Moon Zombie's concerned, like I don't really get the hate behind that. Is she the best actress of all time? No, but I find it admirable and just cool that he is making movies. He's a rock star. He casts his wife in his films. He casts his friends in his films. A lot of directors do that. I was watching Zoolander last night. Ben Stiller uses, a lot of his friends in his movies. Christopher Nolan does it. John Carpenter's done it. So I just think that is that not the dream, is to like make horror movies, be a rock star and live a happy life? Like I've never felt anything wrong with it. I mean, that's just me.
I think it's sweet that he actually casts his wife in all those movies. Like, I know people complain about it because of her acting abilities, but I find like she's pretty good in the first Halloween especially. But yeah. I think it's cute. It's cute that he puts his wife in everything. So
I don't think it's a problem at all. My only real complaint is I don't think I would have written Laurie to have a Charles Manson poster. And like, and Charles, we trust graffiti
Thank
on
you.
Her wall. I know it's furthering the reclusiveness and like the downward spiral of her character, and it's painting this pitch black atmosphere and showing Lori's appearance, like is her darkness manifesting externally, which I can dig that, but I could have done without the poster and like in Charles We Trust. Like that's my biggest complaint if I have one.
I remember seeing the title card and I was like, okay. My problem, first of all, I have no problem with Sherry being in there. We discussed in the last episode, she was one of the highlights of the first one. And I think he did an excellent job of portraying this, struggling mother who really loves her kids and is just struggling with life as a whole. So I have no problem with her being in there. And if this was something, symbolic and something that Michael Myers was seeing, because of that need and that desire. I don't think I would had an issue with it appearing. It's when they both started seeing the exact same imagery to a T, to the point where even that imagery to her is holding her down where she can't move. That's when it became a problem for me, because it's like now they're both seeing the exact same thing. Now it isn't just a mental thing or something that Michael is seeing in there. That was where my issue with it was. That's where it was like, okay, now to me, this is becoming more supernatural. It must be some kind of, you know, apparition or a ghost that they're both seeing, because for them, without having that life experience together as a whole, to see the exact same thing to a T, and at the same time, that doesn't scream psychological, that screams supernatural to me.
I don't know if I felt that it was like supernatural or not, but I can definitely see. I think one of the things I didn't like about it, especially with the first time I watched it, I was like, oh, these visions, like it was just like too much. It was too like not Halloween-y to me. Like I was like, what is this? But then watching it again, I was like, okay, this is a metaphor for something. I don't know if it's like generational trauma, or you know, you can't escape like your family and like hereditary things passed down. Like, is she actually being forced down, or is that just all like a metaphor? Like, I don't know. I don't know if that's supposed to be taken literally, all those things. I'm not sure what Rob Zombie was going for, but maybe someone has an opinion on that. I don't know.
Maybe a little bit later on. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. No, that's just pretty much what I did. Not to say I didn't really like all this movie, but it was such a contrast from the first movie. A bit too drastic of a contrast from the first movie. Like it didn't feel as cohesive as a first one and a second one both together. Like it doesn't really feel like cohesive. I understand and appreciate this vision from Rob Zombie, but I also like it doesn't. They don't really feel like in the same world or realm. But I think, is that bad thing? I don't know. And that was pretty much the only things I didn't really like about it.
Yeah, the only other minor thing I would add is I think I was really missing the kind of like gravity that Dave Ferrick brought to young Michael's performance in 07. I don't think the kid, I don't remember his name, did a terrible job, but you can just tell that Dave Ferrick is just superior as that character, and it was missing the weight of that.
With that character, and it was from the first, because it was right at the beginning of the movie where you see them like at the hospital. Right away, just, I'm not even discussing the acting itself, just seeing the face, I was like no. There was too much emotion in his face. What made it good in the first one is, you know, the blank stare that was in there. So, you know, it seemed more like a robot or something posing as a kid, which made it like more believable. While here, it just, the whole tickle thing, I was like, no, don't tickle him, don't smile. I'm like, because at that point, he's already at the hospital. He's already done all of this. And we didn't see that part of him in the first movie in there. So I don't think he's going to gain that type of childish aspect to him. So I think with the recasting, there was, this kid emoted too much.
Yeah.
And it didn't really fit. So that was my issue with that one.
Yeah, it kind of starts the movie off a little bitter, because you're just like, why are they tickling? This kid's definitely not Michael Myers. And so I had to look past that. But like all of these complaints that I have are just very, very minute and minor of the film and its totality of what it looks like, what it feels like to me. But yeah, wish we would have got Dag back. That would have been cool.
Oh yeah, I forgot about the kid. I forgot about the recasting. I don't know why I even had it there and I didn't just skim past it. But this kid looked too pure. Like his acting wasn't at the same level. And also his face just looked too pure. He looked just like a normal kid, nice kid, you know? And like the first Michael didn't. Like he has a certain look to him with his piercing eyes and everything. He just, he looks like he could mess something up. So that recasting. And also, sorry, I just want to say, the Charles Manson poster and Charlie We Trust. I remember seeing that for the first time. I'm like, really though? But then I think, well, I guess if someone, I mean, not that Charles Manson didn't technically eliminate anybody. He was just in control of people who did things. But I guess you could become obsessed with some sort of serial eliminator if that something like that happens to you and you think, well, why me? Why me? Maybe become like that. But, and I guess maybe they're putting that there because kind of like a homage to the character who Loomis is supposed to be based off of. Maybe like, I don't know if they were putting that in there just for like a little bit of a hint, but I agree with you on the recasting and I agree with you on the poster as well.
For the, I guess, dislike, the only thing, the other big thing that I had here is, and again, it's a contrast between the first and then the second one is, I'm trying to see how to phrase this. In this one, sometimes it seemed killing for killing's sake compared to the first one. So like thinking back at the first one, a lot of those kills, there was a purpose to it. So we start with the bully. There was a purpose with the bully. Then the father, the sister, the boyfriend, you know, there was a connection there. Then there was, you know, the foster parents who probably in his mind kept his little sister away, you know, who tried to replace his mother in there. And I remember in that death scene where he's not just killing her, the foster mother, he's kind of toying with her and showing the picture like, this is my sister, like my family, and kind of showing her that. So, you know, every kill in the first one felt like there was a progression to it and there was a reason for it. Well, in this one, not every kill felt that way. I get the connection with the mom, but I feel like I could have done without the whole strip club scene. Like that, those kills right there felt like we kind of could have skipped over it. And then the friend and the werewolf guy that she was hooking up with, he's just strolling by this party and it just takes him out and then just kind of moves on in there. So some of those, they just felt like he was kind of killing for killing sake. Not all of them, you know, because like the farmers or the ranchers they killed at the beginning, like that, they got in his way. You know, they got aggressive with him. So, Annie, out of both movies, the Annie death, I think, has the most meaning out of both movies put together. So it has the most meaningful death, but as a whole, not every death felt like it had meaning in this one, if that makes sense.
I would push back on that, actually. I think there is meaning behind Michael's rage, and many of the acts of violence he commits are symbolic of his resentment of the lifestyle and characters he grew up with. You know, in the words of Dr. Loomis, Michael was created by a perfect alignment of interior and exterior factors gone violently wrong. And so, for instance, you know, Michael committing these horrific, I'm trying to choose my words carefully because I don't want us to get flagged, but committing these awful acts at the strip club, a place where his mother had worked as a stripper in order to support her children, a workplace that profits off objectifying women. You can look at it as unaliving, representing his resentment towards such an establishment, its employees and the way they conduct business, the same job that kept her away from home and her children and left them to be next to abusive Ronnie. So, and even the unaliving of like the stripper herself feels symbolic in a way, bashing her face into a mirror, disfiguring her face into an object that they kind of rely on their appearance for, figuratively kind of killing or unaliving the existence of that profession, a profession that, like I said, keeps mothers away from their children, a profession that is demeaning to women. And then you look at Howard, the strip club worker by the dumpster. Michael probably would have killed him even if he didn't speak, but Michael doesn't act until Howard starts to belittle him, until he starts calling him names, just like Michael's stepfather Ronnie does. The same thing with the rednecks in the field. And then you look at Lori's friend and the Wolfman guy. To me, that's very reminiscent to Judith and her boyfriend. Just these triggers that Michael just sees. I think there is a significance behind everything.
I didn't think about the strip club scene that way. Like the way you pose it that way, that does make sense. It's a good observation with the mirror aspect in there, and you know, not just outright ending her, but doing in that fashion. So okay, that one changing my perspective a little bit on that scene in there. So that definitely
I've thought
does.
About this for a while, so
yeah,
I don't think it's something that would just like click right away. But yeah.
No, that does fit. That does improve that scene for me. The other one still feels a little random in there with him to happen to be strolling through there and Laurie is like actually really close by, unless he was following her to that place, and then he was like, "I'll get you later. Don't worry about it. I'll meet you at your house." aspect. But the strip club scene, okay, I can see the value in it now for sure.
It all ties
that's
back
the
to
one
his
that,
mom and his family. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's the one that she worked at too. Like, it wasn't just like a random strip club.
I will say this, they won't throw it. I like overall the director's cut better than the theatrical cut.
Yeah.
But I like the theatrical cut's ending better than the director's cut. Like those last 15 minutes or so, that how it played out at the end, I prefer the theatrical cut version, even though I think the director's cut is a better movie because it gives you more meat on the bone when it comes to where Laurie and some of these characters are mentally at that point in time.
Yeah.
So what's I don't know if I've seen the director's cut, but what happens at the end that's different in the theatrical, like that made you like the theatrical better than the director's cut, just out of curiosity.
Yeah, I mean, for me, the problem with the director's cut is, so they come, you know, crashing through the barn. Michael Myers just, you know, got up, he gets his blow in before, so we have Loomis on the ground. And then we see Laurie, you know, come out in kind of a catatonic state, understandably, you know, she just went through some stuff. And then she picks up the knife and stands over Loomis. They're, you know, implying that she is about to go at Loomis with it. And then the cops shoot her up and she goes out to the ground, which, you know, in my mind is it's already been established, because when they tell the sheriff, witnesses saw him carrying this girl into here, and they kind of barricaded themselves. So all the cops are already aware that she is kidnapped by Michael Myers. So this is already known. They're kind of setting the perimeter. They know what's happening there. With her being there with the knife, the quick trigger just didn't make sense for me, especially without the orders of the sheriff, who is there, and he's even had to say, like, you know, cease fire, stop it. But for her standing there with a knife, not a gun or anything like that, it didn't seem realistic that they'll just open fire on the kidnapped victim in that scene. So it felt convenient and kind of forced just to get the imagery of all three of them, you know, the three main characters kind of lying there on the ground, presumably, you know, dead and all of that. I feel like there could have been a different way to get there. I didn't like the way that got executed in that aspect. So that was my main problem with the director's cut ending.
Do you like that ending better, Kevin, than the normal ending? Like that they're all...
Yeah.
Or should we...
I think the theatrical... I think she puts the mask on in the theatrical.
She does, and she's the one that ends Michael in the theatrical.
That's right. That's right. I think Michael might speak in the director's cut where he's like, "Die!" Which I don't like. I don't like that either. But I don't hate it. I just wish he would have said it better. But I honestly wish he didn't speak at all. But I prefer the director's cut ending just because of the song, the Love Hurts song. And I'll get into that more when we wrap this up. But to me, it gives me goosebumps every time I watch it. I prefer that ending. I know it does feel kind of like out of nowhere that she gets lit up by the cops. But also, I mean, I guess you could just say that Lori was meant to die. And maybe Michael's energy just really made everybody rabid and affected everybody in such a negative, foggy way. I don't know. But I do understand that complaint, because it's just like, wait a minute, this is the girl that was kidnapped. Why are you executing her in this field? And so Yeah, I get it. I mean, I guess the only other thing that I would add is that I really love the score by Tyler Bates in this. As great as Carpenter's score is in 78 and how much it elevates that film, I feel like Tyler Bates' score here really captures the essence and the soul of this film. Like they just go hand in hand. He really gives us this auditory glimpse into the derangement and insanity of Michael. And I just had to shout that out because I think it's very underrated and it works.
The score and the whole soundtrack, like every song
Yeah.
choice, I feel like is so good. So, Jose, overall thoughts, Halloween 2 by Rob Zombie. What are your overall thoughts, things you want to touch on? And also, do you agree with the rating system on this, or what would you give it?
Wait, which rating system am I agreeing to? Did we already give a rating?
No, the remember the rating system that Rotten Tomatoes said 44% and
Oh.
25%? Would you,
Yeah.
is that, do you think
Was
that's fair,
25 the
or?
critic?
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Okay. No, I don't agree with that. I think that's too low. Even with the issues I had with it, I wouldn't go. I would definitely at least put it up over 50%. On that aspect, I think that's way too low, and I feel part of that is probably the inability of separating this from the franchise as a whole, which we get with a lot of things, is a lot of times people can't separate those, and they're looking for the same thing, which makes it harder to accept changes, and I think that's a lot of what's bringing that score down. I wouldn't go too high myself because I did have issues with it. And I think if this movie existed in isolation, if it was just this one from Rob Zombie, I think I would have a different outlook on it and I would probably hold it higher in my rating. But I can't look at it that way because if it's a part one and a part two, I have to look at it as a whole. And with it feeling so different in certain aspects between both, that's what brings it down for me. So I still hold the first one above this one significantly, but there are things in there to enjoy. It's not one of those movies where it was like, oh my God, how can people sit through this? There's enough good in there. So for me, it had big problems, but then also really good things in there. So I think for the first one, I forgot what I was. I think I was maybe like high 70s, low 80s for like the first one. This one I might be like mid 60s for this one instead of like that 25 that they gave it. So that's how can I feel it as a whole. What we have to respect about the second one is that this is an opportunity which we don't get too often, especially when you get major properties in here that are expected to bring in money. This is, you have to respect that this is a project where an artist was allowed to put out their vision out there. Whether it's good or not, we don't get enough of that. So credit has to go to that where it was like, this is a vision, this is what it is. And this is on the studio. This is not on Rob Zombie. There needs to be more consistency where if you're gonna do multiple movies, let the artist show their vision from the start so we get a complete cohesive vision. Because if not, then you create this divide that we have in this where it feels like two movies from two different worlds, even though they are connected. So that was like one of my main takeaways with this. And that's on the studio, that's not on Rob.
Yeah, I would also say with 07, I think, again, Rob did such a good job of balancing his style of art while also having to hit familiar notes from 78. Like, you have to implement so many certain scenes and callbacks, and there's so much like studio meddling in there that, again, we are very lucky that it turned out as good as it did. I do think that the first half is predominantly stronger than the second half. I think the second half gets a little muddied with having to hit similar beats. And the first half to me, I just really enjoy everything with young Michael and Smith's Grove all the way up until he finds that mask back at the Myers house. I just think everything just moves at such a good pace and is so different. It's like a breath of air. So I definitely prefer the first half over the second half, but I also love how simple the second half is and it just goes. But I do understand that. And you're actually kind of teeing this up for me, talking about the artistic side of Rob and him kind of flexing his creative muscles and breaking through the constraints and shackles of being in the shadow of John Carpenter. So the main reason why I genuinely love this film is because it doesn't give a fuck. And I respect things that have that type of mindset. It just wants to tell a story. It's not some cheap little derivative product processed through a studio looking to appease everybody, to appease the entire fan base just to generate a profit. It's not interested in pandering or continuing the fallacy of a happy protagonist or exploiting death without wallowing in its cost. It knows exactly what it is, and its only interest, again, is just telling a story and carving its own bold, mean, unapologetic path that is unequivocally confident in its bones, in its DNA, in its style, in its direction, through and through. It is a complete submergence into how horrific life can be, into the misery, into the unrelenting shackles of hell, how we can't escape the cruel hand that can be dealt to us at any given time, and that the scarred aftermath that lingers is here to stay. It leaves such a lasting impression. It's left such a lasting impression on me. I think it's left, no matter how you see it, it's left such a lasting impression on the franchise. If you get it, you get it. If you don't, you don't. But I think if you're someone that just kind of blindly hates it, then go put peanut butter on your and watch Halloween 2018. But I just genuinely adore this film and will always champion it.
I love that. I love how much you love this movie. And Jose, I love that you, I think I feel the same way maybe as you do. Like, I'd probably give it like maybe like a 60 something maybe, but I don't know why I'm giving it less. And I think I had a new appreciation for it last night when I rewatched it. The last third of the movie kind of loses me a little bit just because there's so much of the Laurie and the imagery with the mom, and I maybe I'm just not wrapping my head around it. Maybe I want an actual answer from Rob Zombie what it is. But I feel like ultimately this movie is the deepest Halloween movie that ever will exist. I think I don't think anyone will again take this type of a fab, pun intended, in a Halloween movie this direction. It's kind of not really a slasher movie, and I don't know what it is, like a revenge flick. I don't really know, but I feel like there's so much depth to it that maybe I don't even understand, and that it's a totally more of like a fate, a story of fate, and there's so many metaphors that maybe I wish I could have explained to me, maybe just so I know what Rob Zombie's thinking. But I definitely don't hate it, and I did appreciate it more, I think, last night watching it another time. And also, I like that I picked up on those little Halloween nuggets that I didn't pick up on the first time, because it made me feel a little more connected to it as a Halloween movie. But yeah, that's pretty much how I feel about it.
I was gonna say real quick, yeah, you're right. It's not your stereotypical, you know, slasher. Where you get a lot of slasher is the focus is on the hunt, the cat and mouse game, you know, trying to escape. That's what generally they tend to be focused on. This is focused more on the emotional and psychological aspects that are created by the hunt and the slasher aspects, but that's not the focus itself. It's more on what does this do to the people more than what is the killer doing to the people, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I just think it really balances the human aspect and the supernatural aspect of the Halloween story of Michael Myers in like a really artistic and organic way. And why I love that last shot of Laurie down this white hallway, you can interpret it a million ways, whether she's in an asylum or she's in purgatory. But either way, this was her fate. She was meant to fall into this abyss of rage and misery. It was just what was meant to happen. And Oh, I just get chills thinking about that. I just love how it ends on Love Hurts, and she has that really sinister smile, and then it's over. To me, this is Rob's masterpiece. This is his greatest film, and will forever be his greatest film. And this is my favorite film in the franchise. And through and through, just unequivocally bold, confident, stylistic, and mean. And that's what I love in a horror movie. And also has heart and emotions, and that's just like the cherry on top. And just to kind of like wrap this up overall, I know it's fun to have the shape just be this kind of mindless boogeyman without motive, without any intention. He just lurks and he kills, and that's it. But why is Michael doing what he's doing? I think Michael here is this force of nature on an unstoppable mission to reunite with his baby sister, and he will destroy anything and everything in his path to make sure that he finds her. Why that is, I think it's really fun to think about and to ponder and explore. Like, maybe deep down, that innocent child is still alive and longing for his family. So maybe it's simply a story about love, damaged, misplaced, unbearably painful, confused love. The only love Michael knows hurts him and causes his mental and emotional suffering. He is unable to love, and he is unable to be loved. And I just think in that case, it adds a sympathetic aspect to the shape that no other Halloween film has. Love hurts. Or, maybe there are greater forces at play, and he is simply a vessel of evil for fate to come to fruition. After all, Halloween at its core has always been about fate. And you look at the nightmarish visions that Laurie has the closer Michael gets, where it's like these ghoulish entities are like getting ready to feast on her soul. And I just love the imagery in these nightmares. Like, each step closer that Michael gets, the stronger her psychic and empathic visions and sensations become. And she's confined and trapped in like this locked cage, unable to break. And that is like so symbolic of her position in this horror story that is the Myers family tale. She's unable to escape and break free from, and her captivity within her unraveling mental state, like the locked cage confining her, the inevitability of it all. Fate wins, evil wins. That is Halloween to me.
Hell yeah. Hell
Very
yeah.
well said.
Well, what do you guys think? Do you think everything we're saying is wrong? Is this garbage? Tell us in the comments. We still want to hear it. We still want to hear what you think. Did your eyes become more open to this movie? Are you looking at that in different ways? Because even while we're recording now, we've all had like, wow, never saw it like that. Wow, I never thought about it like that. And this is why you have to have conversations about things that you don't agree with people on, or if someone has a totally different opinion or view, sit down, talk about it, listen, and your eyes are going to be open to something totally new and refreshing, and it might change the way you think about stuff. Like, it's so important to do. That's why I wanted to have you both on. Not that Jose hates it or anything, and not that I hate it, but I knew there was ways that we were going to look at it differently, and then I just love expressing that and sharing that with people, and I think it's so important. So I thank you both for being on here so much. Really appreciate it, you guys. Thank you for watching this deep dive episode of Marie Plays It All. You can find more of our content on our YouTube channel, Not a Strong Start. You can follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Not a Strong Start. You can listen to us anywhere you listen to your podcasts. Like and subscribe and share and comment, all that good stuff. You can follow me on Instagram at Marie Plays It All. Jose, where can we find you?
You can find me at This Is Mi Nombre on Instagram.
Where can we find you, Kevin Ketchy?
You can find me on Instagram at Watch Horror Films, my YouTube, Kevin Ketchy. I have a podcast that I do from time to time, but it's kind of dormant right now, not in the comments. But you can find me at the other two places a lot quicker.
Awesome. Thank you guys so much for being on here. Appreciate you.
Thanks for
Thank you. This
having
was a ton of fun. Thank you for having me.
And never stop playing and never stop, like I said 2 seconds ago, sitting down and listening to other perspectives and views and talking about movies, no matter what. Even if you hate them, even if you love them, just keep never stop talking about them. Never stop sharing.